This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 2, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs. They're intended for your own personal use, and any use of this audio without the express written consent of Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated or your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm going to start taking a look now at some of the developments that have occurred in the past week in the area of federal taxes. And let's begin with Chief Counsel Advice 2015-09037, which deals with a situation where an agent apparently was attempting to misapply Revenue Procedure 2005-31 to deny certain parents the ability to claim an adoption when they adopted a child in a foreign country. That particular revenue procedure deals with a situation where a parent adopts a child in a foreign country and within 2 years readopts that child in their U.S. state that they happen to live in. Now, obviously, the parent's going to have to go through the foreign adoption because, of course, the foreign country is not generally going to just allow one to walk off with children without approving it, but you also may need to finalize this in the U.S. state to be able to be clearly granted status in that state as parent of the child. Therefore, the revenue procedure says that if you do reestablish, basically readopt the child within 2 years, either the year following or 2 years following, the year in which the adoption is final in the foreign country, the parent may elect, for purposes of claiming the adoption credit, to either claim that the adoption was final in the year in which the adoption finalized in the foreign country or in the year in which the adoption is finalized in the U.S. state. The agent apparently was interpreting this to mean that if a parent did not go ahead and readopt the child under U.S. law, that no adoption credit would be allowed. Therefore, if you only adopted the child in the foreign country, or presumably if your U.S. readoption did not take place within that two-year period, the agent thought, well, tough luck, you simply don't have any choice here, you do not get the credit. The email indicates that the revenue procedure was not meant to indicate that parents had to adopt twice in order to claim the credit if they're adopting a child from a foreign country. Rather, if the parents do not have a U.S. adoption, the credit is going to be allowed in the year in which the adoption was finalized in the foreign country. Therefore, as the email concludes, the agent should not be applying this standard against the parents. Next, we'll move on to the case of Duffy versus United States, a case from the United States Court of Federal Claims. This is 115 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-438. This was a case dealing with a taxpayer who claimed to be discriminated in employment. They claimed that there was basically retribution claim when the employee pointed out problems that the employee found with how the employer was reporting things for accounting purposes and violation, as this person felt, of the Sarbanes-Oxley requirements. Now, this particular employee sued, and eventually a settlement agreement was signed with their employer. Now, the settlement agreement that was signed by the employer stated clearly that the exclusive purpose of the agreement was avoiding the expense and inconvenience of further litigation. It specifically also stated they were making no claims about the tax attributes of this payment. In this particular case, Mr. Duffy claimed that, well, because he had suffered certain illnesses that occurred from the stress that he was under because he had been, in his mind, unfairly targeted for his whistleblowing activities, where he had kind of said that, you know, they really shouldn't be reporting this way, and the company he claimed just quieted him down by disciplining him and causing him discrimination in employment. It also claimed that it hurt him because he, prior to coming on with this company as an employee, had a consulting program, and he claimed that he could get no jobs after he left, because the consulting program, you know, basically anybody who wanted to hire him as a consultant in this area, and he specialized in this kind of accounting issue, would obviously ask for some recommendations from his prior employer, and obviously the prior employer wasn't giving recommendations, or at least what they would tell is probably not something that Mr. Duffy really wanted to have gone over with the other people, so for bottom line purposes, he claims unemployable. So he claimed as a secondary point, if he couldn't exclude this under 104 as damages for physical injuries, for physical injuries and illness, he should be able to treat this as a capital gain from basically the damage goodwill that resulted to his business. Unfortunately for Mr. Duffy, the Court of Federal Claims accepted neither view. The court pointed out that the actual agreement stated very clearly the agreement which Mr. Duffy signed and agreed to just before trial specifically stated that the employer was entering into this agreement solely to avoid the cost of additional litigation. It made no mention of compensating him for damages that related from some illness, nor paying him for any goodwill. The court said, A, obviously, based on a number of cases, a mere broad release is not going to be good enough generally to get you damages, to get you the claim that you had damages for physical injuries, unless it's clear that was the only thing you could possibly have been claiming. Secondly, the court pointed out that the only way he could get a capital gain from having been paid for goodwill would have been if he had sold the goodwill to the employer. And the court pointed out there was clearly nothing in the agreement that suggested that the employer had somehow purchased or acquired Mr. Duffy's goodwill from his consulting agency. Therefore, the court found Mr. Duffy had, frankly, just plain vanilla, ordinary income on which he must pay tax on the full amount. The issue of alimony again, and it's an issue, you know, alimony comes up way too often in the courts. And the problem is that qualifying something as deductible alimony is a little bit troublesome. In the case of Resnick versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-11, we had a payment, though, that this one was a little different reason why he lost. In this case, we had payments. He was to pay 75% of the mortgage payments. The court agreed, you know, this is mortgage payments for the house that he used to live in. The court agreed that it met the four requirements generally required for alimony under Section 71B1. It was made under a divorce agreement that was written. The agreement did not designate that these payments would not be taxable as alimony to his former spouse. He and his former spouse were not members of the same household for the year in question, and he was under no obligation to continue to make these payments if his former spouse died. That's normally the big four and what we worry about meeting, and if we meet those four, we have alimonies. But there is one other issue that you always have to consider. If that payment stream, despite the fact it meets all four requirements, will be reduced based on a contingency related to a child, that is deemed not to be alimony. In this particular case, the agreement provided that he paid the 75% of the mortgage payment until the mortgage was paid off or until his oldest child, who was disabled, no longer permanently resided in the home with his mother. The problem there was that that was clearly a contingency related to the child. Now, it was not related to the child graduating from college or high school or the child attaining age 18, the normal things we worry about. It was simply a contingency in case the child presumably passed away, potentially maybe did move out or ended up having an issue that caused the child to be moved into a long-term care facility, something of that sort. George would no longer make the payments on the mortgage because, in theory, we would presume that would free up his former spouse to basically sell the home and move on. So our problem was that George, because he could get out of it based on a contingency, the fact that that contingency either is certain to occur or may never occur doesn't change the fact that it's a contingency based on a child. And that meant that the entire payment stream was considered not to be deductible alimony to George, nor it was considered to be includable alimony income to his former spouse. The takeaway from this, as is always true, is you have got to get a copy of the divorce decree and read it and watch for the four criteria and then start looking for any other conditions that may cause the alimony to cease, being very aware that anything that mentions a child is a problem for purposes of deductible alimony. Flip side, if you're representing the spouse receiving the payments, anything related to the child potentially takes that out of being in their income. You don't want to foul it up either way. So we want to make sure that we're very careful about watching for those things. Next, we move on to Private Letter Ruling 2015-09-020. This is an interesting one where we're taking a look at the problem when things just got a little bit chaotic for a tax preparer. And the preparer forgot to do something that he had apparently agreed to do to the partners of the partnership. And that forgetfulness turned out to be potentially expensive for the partnership. And to make matters even worse, the problem was discovered when he was replaced, and a new preparer was brought in to prepare the partnership's return. So what was our issue here? This partnership had a building. Basically, that was its major asset. This building previously had a single tenant who, when the economy went south, in essence, closed that location. Therefore, they lost their major tenant, were unable to find a new tenant. Now, the partnership had borrowed money to buy this building, and now they were no longer really able to pay on the debt. So they went back to the lender and negotiated a restructuring of the debt, a restructuring that included, basically, cancellation of indebtedness structures in it. So the amount of debt they would eventually pay, the principal they'd eventually pay, under the terms effectively was reduced. That meant the partnership had cancellation of debt income. So when this happened, the partnership talked with their tax advisor, and the tax advisor pointed out that if this was qualified real property that was used in a trade or business, it could qualify for electively a treatment for exclusion of the cancellation of debt income from the partner's returns. But for that to be true, the partners had to individually file elections on the return. Now, we should add, that's something you should know is required, because partnerships, in essence, when we deal with cancellation of debt, all the provisions of 108 that keep it out of income have to be applied at the individual owner level, not at the partnership level. So this election had to be made at the partnership level. Now, what the advisor told them, and it would appear the advisor did not tell them that they had to make partners individually, had to make the elections, just that he would take care of all the documents that the partnership and the partners had to deal with in order to get this relief. Now, following this, but before the year ended, a partner dies. So, and the partnership had a 754 election in place. Because of that, we're going to have to get a valuation done, right, so that we can restate the basis of the real estate in order to determine what the 743 adjustment to be passed out to the new partner, that is, whoever inherited that share, is going to have to pick up as their adjustment. Probably, unfortunately, in this case, that's probably a negative adjustment, but that wasn't really our major problem. Our major problem was that this apparently distracted the advisor. And what happened was that this appraisal was going to take a while to get together. We're in the middle of March, and the partners, not surprisingly, are getting very nervous because they want to have the returns and the information and numbers from the returns so they can do their own individual returns. Any of you that have done partnership returns, we've all seen that, where the individual partners start asking, when is my K-1 coming? And they don't like to hear that, well, we've got an appraisal that needs to be done because Joe died. And of course, the next question is, well, why does that affect me? And then secondly, and it turns out, well, it doesn't really affect you, but we can't do the partnership return until we get that done. So they start saying, well, I want my numbers because I want to file on time. Many of these individuals seem to believe that if they ever go on extension, that the IRS will immediately show up the next morning to audit their return. So they absolutely do not want to go on extension. So to take care of this, the advisor prepared a draft partnership return with draft K-1s, looking primarily at giving those partners the numbers they would need to prepare their returns. Now the advisor did go ahead and reduce the basis of the assets as if the elections had been made by the partners. But he neglected to tell the partners that they needed to actually put a Form 982 on the return and make this election. So each of the partners had to do that, or there would be no valid election and no reduction of basis. There rather would be pickup cancellation of income. He also neglected to put the COD income itself on the draft K-1s, presumably, of course, because they weren't going to pay tax on it. So we end up running down this road. The partners file their returns. The partnership then files the tax return, still missing the COD income flow through, but with all the basis adjustment. So at the end of the day, what's happened is all the partners have filed the returns with the proper numbers if the election had been made, but nobody's made the election. The next year, the partnership hires a new tax advisor, and the new tax advisor, doing his due diligence review of prior returns, notices that, it appears that the partners were supposed to have gotten these 982s. Presumably, the advisor says, well, I don't have copies of them. You know, can you guys assure me that you actually attach 982s to your return? and got back the proverbial blank stares. Determined, therefore, that nobody had filed this form. What happens at this point is now the ones that have problems are the individual partners. So the bad news here is there are a whole slew of private letter rulings. Private letter ruling 2015-09-020 is just one of many issued this week to the partners of this partnership. Each of the partners had to get their own ruling. Bad news, they also each had to pay their own fee, which is really bad news. But the IRS did agree that, in fact, the partnership should be allowed to make a late election. Now, what they depend on here is relief that's granted under Regulation 301.9100-3. And that is the IRS's discretionary ability to basically waive late elections if the election due date is set by regulation and not statute, which this one is, the taxpayer acted reasonably and in good faith, and a grant of relief will not prejudice the interests of the government. One of the ways the taxpayer shows they acted reasonably in good faith and that their acting will not prejudice the interests of the government is if they meet the requirements for reliance on a professional. To meet those requirements per the regulation, they cannot be seeking to alter a position for which a penalty has been or could be imposed under the accuracy-related rules of 6662. They have to have been informed in all aspects of the require. They could not have been informed of the aspects, I should say, this is could not have been, of all the aspects of making the election but failed to do so, so we have to show we weren't told about this, and we cannot use hindsight in requesting relief. Primarily when the IRS looks at that, they're going to look at whether or not you really would not have made the election. You now just know it had been a really good thing to make it. And so now, even though it wouldn't have been clear at the date that the election would have been due that it was going to work out for you, now you know it will. So now you want to do it. In this case, the IRS found they met all the requirements. Good news, as I said, is the IRS did not require them to go back and effectively have to basically restate the returns. Bad news was we needed to go get private letter rulings. In Chief Counsel Advice 2015-09-029, the IRS held that a truck dealer that claimed their service bays were like service stations and therefore should qualify for 15-year life under asset classification 51.1 asset class, I should say 51.1, the IRS didn't buy that deal. The IRS and Chief Counsel Advice specifically concluded that you could not be like a service station unless you actually sold fuel. And this taxpayer admitted they did not actually sell fuel, they sold other products. The advice also takes a look at problems here about that where they couldn't show that more than 50% of their income related to, because they tried to lock in oil changes and other such things for the buildings that were for providing for the, that had the service bays in them. The IRS claimed they could not show that in fact that was more than 50% of the income, nor could they show that they had met the square footage. So the IRS found that there was no way to justify these as 15-year and not 39-year property. Therefore, basically told the agent it was fine to go ahead and force an accounting method change with a pickup of the excess depreciation in the first year available under the examination that was open for change to pick that up and put these over 39 years. If you have truck dealers or other dealers that are attempting, other vehicle dealers that are attempting to claim their service bay areas are like service stations and get 15-year lives, I certainly suggest you read this chief counsel advice to see the IRS position. Next up, in Lesgaspy versus Commissioner, summary opinion 2015-14. This one's a little scary because the IRS denied a non-cash contribution, or the tax court did, due to a lack of statements that no goods or services were received. Now, that's bad because the charity in question was Goodwill, and this was a rather standard Goodwill receipt they hand out whenever you come by and drop stuff off. The taxpayer had pictures of what he had given, at least the furniture part. Now, one problem was he claimed it was worth over $4,900, and I presume that the IRS, that may have been part of the reason why the court was skeptical. The court just found this the easiest way to deny it, but here's the problem. Anytime you make a contribution, cash or non-cash, that is more than $250 claim deduction, you must have a statement stating that you received nothing. This is lacking on this statement, and it's a problem. Also, the tax court was critical of the fact that he had not obtained a third-party appraisal. That's really scary for these types of contributions because it doesn't likely not going to be financially viable for most people to go get an appraisal. Now, technically, the law doesn't require appraisals in this case. The only problem was the tax court's commentary makes it a little bit concerning. The one piece of good news is this is a summary opinion. The bad news, of course, is that what they actually denied it upon, no statement that nothing was given, is unfortunately a statutory provision. Finally, just in case this applies to your taxpayers, if they give medical benefits that are on the high end and may be subject to the Cadillac tax, you should definitely take a look at Notice 2015-16. The IRS is asking for comments regarding the application of the Cadillac tax on health care plans. Looking for, they gave possible rules and asked for comments on the definition of applicable coverage, the determination of the cost of applicable coverage, and the application of the dollar limit to coverage. Remember, this is going to impose an excise tax of 40% of the excess of the cost of such coverage over a baseline amount. Therefore, if your client is already over those amounts, and you can take a look at that online and take a look at the proposed way of calculating what the benefit is, you may want to be concerned about following through and seeing what's happening here. The purpose of the Cadillac tax is clearly to force these plans out of the market. You need to start talking with your clients about the fact that in 2018 this may be coming. Be aware, don't fall in the trap lots of people fell into earlier regarding things coming up in the Affordable Care Act and just ignore the problem till the year of change. As we discover, sometimes we have to do this. While we may get a wave off, you have to tell clients we might not, and if we don't, here's your consequence. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 3rd, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE. You can find information about today's items and links to the source documents at our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I'll be back next week and talk to you about the items that have occurred in the upcoming week in the area of federal taxes.